This is a recorded transcription of William F. Buckley's program Firing Line, recorded in 1972. The subject, the new populism. The program begins in 30 seconds.
The candidacy of George McGovern is off to a ripping start, largely because of the appeal of what they are nowadays calling the new populism. By happy coincidence for the authors, they brought out during the same season a book on the new populism called A Populist Manifesto, The Making of a New Majority. In a previous book, one of the authors, Mr. Jeff Greenfield, describes how the new populism is going to carry Mayor John Lindsay triumphantly to the Democratic presidential nomination in Miami. But we all make mistakes, some of us more than others. And the current volume carries a testimonial on the front cover by the renowned economist and politician Jimmy Breslin. Mr. Greenfield is an honors graduate of the University of Wisconsin and the Yale Law School, who went almost directly from school to ghostwriting for Senator Robert Kennedy. After the senator's assassination, he went to the staff of Mayor Lindsay and a year or so ago retired to do freelance writing. He is, of course, familiar to viewers of Firing Line as a regular panelist over a period of 2 years. Mr. Jack Newfield is a graduate of Hunter College who has been an associate editor of the Village Voice since 1964. And has been widely published in the most conspicuous and the most inconspicuous journals in this country. He has written 3 books, including A Prophetic Minority and Robert Kennedy, A Memoir. It has been said about him that his profession is anger and his hobby indignation. I should like to begin by focusing on some of the economic analysis of A Populist Manifesto. And I would like to ask Mr. Newfield whether he wants to take money from those who have it, primarily because he doesn't want them to have it, or because the money is itself critically needed elsewhere.
Well, I think the premise we began with in this book was the notion of equality and fairness. And I think at most points in the book I try to make a distinction between earned income and unearned income. Therefore, in like the chapter on tax reform, we think it is just fair and just. For example, in 1970, Gulf Oil had a net income of $990 million and paid a rate of taxes of 1.2%. The woman who scrubs the floors in the halls of Standard Oil makes $6,500 a year and pays a tax rate of 15% or 17%. That seems to me just fair.
Was there a substantial rise in the price of Gulf Oil that year?
I don't know.
How come you didn't look it up? It seems very important, because if it, in fact it was a windfall, then the price of the stock would have gone up.
The cleaning woman didn't own stock anyways.
No, we're not talking about, right now we're talking about Gulf Oil.
Talking about the price of the oil bill or the price of the stock?
I'm talking about the price of the stock.
The price of the stock in 1970 probably didn't rise because of there was a general decline in the market. The key, I thought you were going to mention the rise of oil prices, which is part of their other form of unearned wealth, which is the oil import quota, which is, I know you're opposed to on free market grounds.
But it seems to me that just to deal with this as a symbol, when we say the Gulf Oil had $964 million.
$990 million.
$990 million. A quarter of a billion has that. And paid no
taxes.
And paid no taxes.
To him, it means nothing.
And paid no taxes.
A rate of 1.2%.
I think it is important to distinguish whether this was a windfall or whether this was a normal reaction to a situation, the context of which would supply an explanation.
Well, also the 60s, they paid between 1% and 5% rate of tax. And the point I was trying to make is that the average working man in this country will pay, I paid a 26% rate of tax. Somebody who earned $8,000 a year probably paid 14%. Basic unfairness.
I hope you are familiar with the rather fundamental economic analysis, which is the corporations don't really pay a tax at all. They just hoist the price of their products and pass along to the consumer. After all, in a competitive economy, and oil is, of course, competitive, they can't afford to pay, actually, a tax. They simply pass that along to the consumers. So that there is a sense in which if they paid no tax at all, and the value of oil, therefore, went down, the price of gasoline would go down, and this would benefit you and
In fact, doesn't happen.
It's just a gathering system.
Yeah, but
corporation taxes.
But the interesting thing about that is, when you talk about oil, you talk about one of the more egregious examples of what we would call unearned wealth. That is, in the business sense, wealth which is accumulated not by initiative or the turning out of a superior product, since in the case of gasoline, there really almost is no such thing.
Well, do you consider the initiative to discover oil in the Arctic Circle?
Let me conclude the point.
I suppose somebody got off the Enterprise and go up there to begin with.
Not necessarily, particularly if the point which I was making, which was more general and I think more important, being that as apart from marketing a superior product, one is in a system where the government protects you from imports through an oil import quota, which I know you're familiar with, and protects the income of a company by giving them a depletion allowance and other intangibles, which reduces their effective rate of taxation enormously. Now, there's the evidence about the price of, let's say, home heating oil, of which Gulf and many other companies are in business, is that it is substantially higher, particularly in the East Coast, where the import quota has its greatest effect. And the interesting thing is that the profits are not passed on to the consumer. What has happened is that the consumer is put in a position where he pays an unfairly high rate because of one form of what we would call unearned wealth.
Well, but has it occurred to you that the consumer might be paying an unnecessarily high rate because depletion allowances are not as great as they might be?
Well,
you do presumably subscribe to the general principle that the more abundant the commodity, the less the price of it to the consumer in non-monopoly situations.
And what makes the position of the oil company so hypocritical is that while the depletion allowance is supposed to encourage exploration within the United States for so-called national security purposes, which is the premise of the oil import quota too, Morton and to the Washington Post found that their explorations have been much greater overseas, where they were paying virtually confiscatory rates to Arabian governments. And one of the reasons for that is yet a third source of unearned wealth,
tax
which is the dollar-for-dollar tax rebate. Yeah. So a lot of times there are things that ought to happen. I mean, one really would expect with a 22% depletion allowance and an abnormally low tax rate, abnormally low as compared to other corporations, 8.8% versus almost 50%, you would expect the price of oil and gasoline to be dropping. And the fact is that the price of oil and gas in the United States is not dropping, it is rising.
That's economic childishness.
No, it's economic rationality.
No. Sure. Give me 35 uninterrupted sentences, seconds.
That would take the whole show.
That's a telethon already, come on.
And I'll tell you why. In the first place, the depletion allowance dropped 7 points in 1969.
5 points.
You
must make a lot of money. $10 million, $2 or $5 million. That's a lot of difference to the oil company.
Yeah, let's be grand about it. And
no, let's be factual, Bill. 5%.
It dropped.
5%.
It dropped 5%.
Right.
And if it had dropped 7%, what? Would that tell me where in my analysis it would have made a difference if I had leaned on 7 rather than 5%, okay? Just as I go along. All right. It dropped 5%. As a result of which, obviously it became less rewarding to oil entrepreneurs to go out and look for oil, point one. Point two.
Point one, which is wrong, but go ahead.
But if we establish a correlation, you said a moment ago that the purpose of it was to encourage an economic coalition. Since
And I said that it was not, in fact, the case.
Yes. And you said you would think that people would proceed to look for oil with all of those inducements in the tax law, to which I reply, the tax law in the first instance, it came in under Roosevelt, is now 40 years old, so that the market has, quote, discounted that incentive, and the shares already reflect the 27% depletion allowance rate. When it goes down 22%, the shares go down. But there's nothing in the world to prevent anybody, assuming this is a productive use of free money, to proceed to look for oil and gas if the tax structure is such as to encourage the search for it. So if you just say, you would think that they would go out and look for gas and oil since the government makes it so profitable for them, begs the question, why don't they?
No.
Who's telling them they can't?
No, I said I would think if the oil companies were telling us the truth that that would be the result. The facts are otherwise.
The oil company is you and me and the lawyer to whom we pay $25 and we constitute ourselves an oil company. You are aware that there are
thousands... They may be you, babe, but they ain't me.
There are people much poorer than you, my friend, who have gone out and struck oil. H.L. Hunt was one of them. If there's
you
any...
You mean J. Paul Getty, don't you?
Some people write books...
Well, you do mean J. Paul Getty, not H.L. Hunt.
H.L. Hunt. H.L. Hunt was much poorer than you when he struck oil. I know, my father lent him money. Now...
I what read that?
Now, the fact of the matter is that you choose to write books, and some people choose to look for oil. But you always introduce the mystique of the large oil companies.
Oh, no, but there's a difference. The
answer is that if you want to go out and look for oil, you hire yourself a geologist, and then you put out a prospectus, and you go out and look for money. And people put out the money, or they don't put out the money, depending on their expectation of return. And the more profitable it is in terms of the rates of return in case they are successful, the more oil and gas...
That's charming. I mean, it really is like a picket fence from the apple tree. But the way you get oil today is you form a cartel and you go to a sheikdom that has a lot of oil and you pay them a confiscatory rate and deduct it from your income.
That's oil development. That's oil development. I'm talking about oil discovery. You do know the difference.
I'm talking about
oil. The discovery of oil is, for the most part, done by small companies venturing out here. Then, when they strike it, turn it over traditionally to the major for development.
See, and now we're at a basic point, which is, but if the tax law wants to encourage those kinds of people, one can develop a tax system to do so.
And I'm saying that your whole point, is like your whole book, is largely a phony because it is based, in my opinion, on a terribly naive understanding of economics. You say, why shouldn't the corporations pay more? The answer is, what the hell do the corporations care how much they pay in the last analysis? They care in this sense, that it's going to price a product up. If it prices a product up, you are eventually victimized by any demand unless it's inelastic, and you have a hell of a time selling outside. And if you don't sell outside, you get the devaluation of the product, and you get ultimately the devaluation of the dollar, and you get inflation. So it was Kennedy and Johnson, both of whom you once lionized, who said, for heaven's sake, let's decrease the tax on corporations.
As a matter of fact,
you have too much style. You're against style now.
We explain how their tax policy hurt middle America.
Yeah, I know. They were the ones who wrote...
There's your demonstration and theirs, and it's still moot, which is correct. All I'm saying is that in the ideal situation, the product that are manufactured in this country would sell for as little as possible. And they're going to sell for as little as possible only if you relieve them of the tax burden.
No.
But in a perfectly competing society, provided the application is uniform, and I recognize the distinction that you bring up about the corporations that are taxed only 25%, if the tax is uniform, they are simply going to increase the price of the tomatoes uniformly, and everybody's going to be, and they're paying more tomatoes. But somehow they're going to think, well, at least the corporations are paying.
Which is why, of course, following the biggest tax cut to corporations in modern history, we had inflation, right? I mean, there were other reasons for inflation, but the fact is, after the 1964 tax cut, prices didn't go down. They began their steepest rise since World War II.
We also had a $50 billion deficit during the succeeding 5 years.
I know that, but what I'm trying to say is there was no evidence of price reduction, even, among those businesses that got the benefit of the tax cut. In other words, what we're dealing with is a basic conflict, if you want to call our interpretation.
Yeah,
Tony, that's one thing.
Do you have the figures on the recapitalization of some of those companies in 1964, 65, 66 in the first place? The reform tax did not come in until 1964, correct?
That was on its
path. The effects were not felt really until 1965. During that period and during the period of the investment credit, a certain amount of money went in towards new plant and equipment and towards the maximization, the increase in the capitalization per job. This is the key index for the productivity of a country.
And of course, what a great deal of it went into also was dividends to shareholders.
Well, in the first place, dividends to shareholders did not rise pari passu with the GNP during most of those years. Dividends for shareholders, as you know, have oscillated considerably. During the last two or three years, during the years that your high dudgeon was being lit, in fact, profits went down 40%. But wages didn't go down 40%. God knows the wages of government employees who will be executors of the new populism didn't go down.
They went up 42%.
We'll get into that later. But in fact,
25% higher than industrial wages.
See, that's the distinction you're erasing. The distinction between business per se, which is not the target of this book, and those enterprises, business, government, labor, et al., that hold illegitimate degrees of concentrated power.
Okay, let's talk about that. My thesis is that the new populism depends on a hobgoblin. The name of the hobgoblin is the rich and the powerful. The general assumption is that those people who are rich are also powerful. In fact, that's nonsense. Both of you have much more influence than H.L. Hunt. And the third general assumption is that all you have to do is elect George McGovern or John Lindsay or...
Can I explain, and you simply change
all the taxes around, all of a sudden the money starts gushing.
The first sentence of the book says...
That you're willing to give some of your money away.
No.
That's the second
This manifesto no. is a platform for a movement that does not yet exist. It is not a book about the 1972 campaign or a blueprint for utopia.
You wrote it before you knew the McGovern was going to be successful.
We wrote this book last summer.
Yeah.
We say that we believe that there are certain long-term trends in a society, a certain consciousness that is developing among blue-collar workers that they have been screwed. The burgeoning registration of young people, the blacks, women, there are all kinds of movements in the society which are in the very embryonic stages of self-consciousness and self-definition. We believe that if there is going to be a new populism in this country, it's going to be a movement which is spread over several years. It will not be connected to one politician or one party. Parts of it will be electoral, parts of it will be the ecological movement, the women's movement, the consumer movement that Nader is trying to organize, new kinds of union leaders like Cesar Chavez. It is not particularly tied to electoral politics.
No, I'm not saying that you intended to sort of tie it.
We said all we had to do was elect George McGovern.
That is the last thing.
Well,
exactly what we're not
right.
saying.
Robert Townsend, who's enthusiastic about your book, says all you have to do is elect George McGovern.
Go talk to Robert Townsend.
I don't mind
that. You're putting other people's burdens on us.
I don't think anybody will find it hard to accept that George McGovern is the symbol of the new populism. And you happen to have written a thing called the New Populist Manifesto. There isn't a sentence in that book that I know of that would be disowned by George McGovern.
A whole chapter on labor.
Oh, of course, that's right. Yes,
well, now right away.
And Israel, I suppose, if you have something on Israel.
Have you read it?
But I mean, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I noticed these sort of modal points at which your quantified modifiers of what you just said become qualitative. Is that there?
I thought you make your book. Relevant.
Thank you. Friends like you, who need...
There are a few central ideas that I think the book either stands or falls. One is the notion that power and wealth are unfairly distributed in the country. I mean, I don't pretend to be an economist or a theoretician or an ideologue.
But now, how do you define unfair?
Where
If you work 10 hours a day and I work 1 hour a day, is it fair for you to have 10 times as much as I do now?
That's not how I define it. I define it as unfair. Let me define it. That is, I want my children, the day they are born, to have as much of a chance to succeed in life as the children of Carter Burden, or Ted Kennedy, or Nelson Rockefeller. I think they should not, at the day they are born, whether they have a 40 IQ or 140 IQ, have $1 billion to start with.
The only thing to do is to consult a eugenic bank. Every time one has a child.
Yeah, because, in
point of fact, a person's intelligence and industry and odd combinations of the two tend to account much more for the success of somebody than his parents. As you know, they're all like idiot rich parents because you know how to corner the soybean market.
And their children are idiot rich.
And so
their children do not go on welfare.
And therefore they marry three or four people and have polo ponies. So what do you care? Do you really care?
Well, they buy a congressional seat.
I care.
Who was it for?
Did you ever meet Andy Stein lately?
Well, Andy Stein, the last time I heard him was giving a point of a seat
to $250,000 to run for the assembly in New York City. His father happened to be a millionaire.
Oh, so he bought
a seat. Jeff wanted to run for that seat.
And he bought a seat like Ottinger, huh?
Right.
You see, you know,
bought the presidency like Rockefeller.
I have a feeling that...
Yeah, Rockefeller beat Nixon, I've forgotten.
If with friends like you are only enemies, with friends like Nixon, you don't need to be rich, you know.
I'm simply saying that if you want people to start fairly in the race, you're much better off going to a eugenic bank and getting the relevant things and having test tube babies, because that's going to do a hell of a lot more for equality than money.
That's
I assure you.
That's not true.
You can take $25,000, let's say, which might be the capitalization of the job, and simply give it to somebody, and that's not going to necessarily give him.
I'm just talking about everybody starting fairly in the race. In life, when they're born, they depend on their imagination, their IQ, their endurance.
But
their
what's
temperament.
Fair about that?
Why
would you saddle somebody if it was scientifically ascertainable that Mary and John would result in little Joe with a very, very low IQ? Why do you accept that unfairness? It seems to me a natural extension of your philosophy of intervention.
I didn't write a natural extension of it. I wrote what I thought at a particular period of time.
Yeah, but I'm urging you to think more.
You're saying you should
treat people equally, all right. And you say in your book, in effect, you're saying that, as George McGovern says, that if somebody earns $51,000 a year, you ought to be taxed at a much higher rate than somebody who earns $49,000 a year. How are you treating people equally?
Fairly. Look, if a business, this may shock you, get a good grip on yourself. If a businessman goes out and builds a better mousetrap, he's entitled to a profit. That's right. Because this is not a socialist manifesto, and it is not even a collectivist manifesto in most parts. In fact, it's quite the reverse. We think that the case for fairness can be made on the progressive income tax on a series of grounds with which you, I'm sure, have debated ad nauseum, namely that the less percentage of one's income is needed for necessities if you make $300,000 a year than if you make six, that there is a certain explicitly redistributive factor there, that you try to collect taxes in such a way that you start the next generation out something close to the starting line. We don't think that you can create a society. Perhaps you could, but one shouldn't try, certainly not in America, to create a society where everyone gets coupons at the start of their life or any given year and spends 8 credits. That's not what we're talking about. But when you have a situation where concentrated economic power in industries boosts up the prices for necessities, then we say it makes sense to pass legislation to do something about that. We've had
give me an example.
Steel, auto, cereal.
Steel.
No, let's take breakfast cereals. Much better. It's much more necessity. Breakfast cereal.
Okay.
If you accept the economic evidence that concentrated industries tend to have inflated costs and prices, it's not just profits. There's a whole other series of built-in extra costs, namely the fact that they are insulated from market competition. And if that boosts the price of necessity, then there are remedies at hand for that. There is a way to make the economic society somewhat fairer, not equal, and certainly not equal in a communalist sense. You know, everybody gets the same. just that one can erase some of those kinds of unfairness.
Okay, let's be more concrete and discuss that. You're saying that the breakfast cereal is not a competitive enterprise?
That's right.
It isn't.
That's right.
Well, then let's not talk about it, because I'm only interested in talking about competitive enterprises.
You better get some other kind of economy than the current American economy.
I mean, let's be thought to be monopoly laws. I'm all for it. And I've been urging Democratic administrations to do that for years.
Right, and you're right. And they failed miserably because they've been sucked into this dream of technological management instead of policy vision. Well, now, instead of just now, we're on a certain path. That's two chapters right there.
However,
let's keep going.
However, I don't concede that there is an inelastic demand for breakfast cereals. I've gone 5 years without having breakfast cereal,
okay.
And here I am. So, it seems
what
to me...
What conclusion do you draw from that, Bill?
It's obviously... It's obviously, therefore, something one can do without, and if one can do without it, then the effects of monopoly aren't particularly...
Do without it. Look, can I give you a better example? All right? Not yet exactly. Let's take bread. You gone without bread for the last 5 years?
You know what?
Yeah?
Do I know what?
I say, have you gone without bread the last 5 years?
No.
Okay. Now, let's take a city like Seattle, where the bakers got together, the distributors, and they drove up the price of bread in Seattle as opposed to neighboring cities where this, 20%, so that a family paid for bread, which is a staple, right? 20% more. The antitrust laws ought to operate, break up that price fixing conspiracy, right?
Are you going to become a law and order man at this stage in your career? Because I welcome you to our ranks.
I believe that you've not really read the book. I started to explain what we're trying to say in this book. We can debate what Nat Spernbanks or George McGovern's standard, but what's in the book. There is one of the things we try to do is to redefine what's left and right and try to synthesize a few ideas which are traditionally sort of as conservative, which I agree with and which we agree with in this book. There is a whole chapter on crime. I happen to feel very strongly about street crime. I believe that both liberals and the new left have copped out
about the problem of street crime, and we try to come up with a
program about it. I believe that conservatives have been right about bureaucracy, about the technocrats and experts, about the excesses of labor unions. That's what's in the book, not Spernbank.
No, I didn't say Spernbank in the book. I said that.
You said you suddenly become a law and order man. Well, I don't know what that means.
This is a reference to your past, which if you want to forget about it, I agree with you.
Well, that's what you're talking about.
What?
We're both.
What is this?
You were probably just being provocative all those years.
No. Well, I was trying to point out some logical inconsistencies, of which there was a plethora whenever you spoke.
I am now
a law and order man is to what, Dale? Have I rioted through the streets of a major university town? Have I busted up churches? Have I gone out and played Bonnie and Clyde? Have I glorified the Black Panthers? What reference is that other than a rather shoddy, to be frank, debate or point?
My reference is to the fact that we have, those of us who believe in law and order, have taken off a lot of abuse.
Is it war and order?
We've taken off a lot of abuse during the past 4 or 5 years from people who insist as Ramsey Park would be an example, that our whole approach is punitive and regressive.
I happen to believe that Richard Nixon has been soft on crime. I wish he would do more about the heroin problem. I wish he would be tough about gun controls. I wish he would do something about prison reform.
Think we should impeach Warren?
We'll wait for that.
What about
the
new
let's talk
about the new populism.
It's important. Let's get back to
the title of the show.
And the relevance of it is, just for your edification and greater euphemic information, that our view of what street crime does to its victims is, to use an overused term, it oppresses them. A neighborhood. And, Jack and I have been to these countries.
I said that when I ran for mayor in 1965.
And you may have been right. I mean, your solutions may have been, bills, but I don't remember, frankly. I was elsewhere. The fact is that a neighborhood that is locked in at night
is
oppressed. Right. They are victims. And perhaps some of our harshest language is reserved for those kinds of credit card revolutionaries who can get off, on a kind of violence trip that they themselves are too either cowardly or outbred to take. They wouldn't do it, but when they see a man stand up and pull a gun, or shout slogans, or glorify every criminal as a revolutionary, it fulfills some kind of rather twisted need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a direct and you know, kind of outraged attack on that view in this book. That's why we left
now,
at your shot that now we're law and order people.
So sometime along, I think who in the hell was president, Theodore Roosevelt, we passed a law saying that those bakers in Seattle shouldn't be allowed to do that. And I'm all for that law. I'm all for strengthening that law.
Good.
But I hope, I know that you say that there's nothing particularly new in your book, but there's things that are newer than that in your book.
Hopeful.
What
That's 595, you know.
Yeah.
Hope.
But you have in...